Welcome to Blackter. Join me as I examine the best of Black artists in my quest to becoming one myself. Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of Blackter. I am your host, Gabe Moses. This is the season finale of Season 2, the final episode of the season, and it is sure to be a good one. I had to cut the season short due to other commitments, but I am so thankful to you for going on this journey with me. The subject of today's episode is the playwright of the hit Broadway play, Passover, the one and only Antoinette Chinoy Nwandu. I had the privilege of interviewing Antoinette about a month ago. Passover premiered on Broadway on August 4th and closed on October 10th, starring John Michael Hill, Namir Smallwood, and Gabriel Ebert. Nwandu's opening words, "You'll kill me now, bang bang," were the first to be heard on a Broadway stage since March of 2020. Throughout the episode, we talk about the birth of Passover, her personal growth with the play, and her small act of self-care, which resulted in a new beginning to Broadway. This is Antoinette Chinoy Nwandu. So, without further ado, let's get into it.
Miss Antoinette Nwandu, welcome. Thank you so much for being here to talk with me.
Thank you for having me, Gabe. Thank you.
Of course, yeah. So, you know, I just have to say congratulations on everything. I'm sure it's been quite the year for you.
Yeah, it has. I mean, to go from shutdown to Broadway is a bit of a whiplash moment, but it's historic. Beautiful. It's a leap. Yeah. It's a leap.
Yeah. So before we get into your success on Broadway with your play Passover, I want to talk about where it really started for you. Can you take me back to that first inkling, that first interest you had in the arts, and where you started with it growing up?
Ah, gosh, that's so interesting. You know, it's taken me a long time to be able to trace my love of writing and of storytelling and of art making through my childhood, even though it was always there, but I just didn't recognize it as such because I wasn't self-consciously being called an artist or told that I was making art. But, you know, my very first story that I made and I sent to my grandmother was when I was 5 years old. So I've always been a writer. I just don't think that, you know, because I wasn't in the art programs and because I wasn't going to the schools or I didn't have the voices and the people saying, yes, you're making art. I see you making art. Let's go watch some art now that's like the art that you're making. You know, you kind of have to go back and find those moments. So, yeah, I mean, I've always been a writer, even though I didn't always know I was a writer, but I didn't know I was a writer really until, gosh, grad school. Yeah. I remember the moment that I first started telling people, telling the world, telling myself that I was a writer. That wasn't until grad school. I was already in grad school for playwriting.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, I was still struggling with claiming that and saying that with my voice. So, yeah. You know, it's a process.
Sure. With any art form, definitely it's a process. And would you say that you sort of began to found your voice as a writer in grad school?
No, I think I was crafting my voice before grad school, but again, one of the necessary components, I think, of living as an artist and being an artist is the self-awareness that you are an artist. Mm. And I think for so many people, or I can even speak just for myself, if you grow up in a situation or a home environment where artistry and art making does not seem like a path you could ever take, then you could be an art making person without ever knowing, hey, I'm an artist. And so, you know, in your mind, you're like, I gotta go to school. I gotta be a doctor, lawyer. You know what I mean? All the things, teacher, right. Something.
All the good things that'll bring in money.
Exactly. But right. But this journey is teaching me, no, my art making, you know, for some of us, that this art making can also be career making.
Yeah. That's a big thing to think about.
Yeah.
And so, you know, did you ever see yourself getting to a stage or a place like Broadway early on when you were kind of, you know, figuring out your style and your voice and your craft?
No, I didn't. Up until literally, I would say before I had the first meeting about Broadway, my expectation was that Passover was gonna, you know, yes, it had an off-Broadway run, and then I expected it was gonna maybe have some regional productions, which it did. And then I thought I was gonna write my next play. Like my next world premiere off-Broadway play was supposed to happen in 2020. Like if the pandemic hadn't happened, I would have just had another off-Broadway play. And I thought that I was gonna have a few of those. And then maybe one day, you know, like Dominique Morisou or Katori Hall, maybe one day I would do the book of a musical. Dominique obviously has Ain't Too Proud, and Katori has Tina. So, and I love both of those, you know what I mean? And so that's a kind of a path. Also Terrell has Choir Boy, his original play with music. And so you see those people getting to Broadway and you're like, okay, maybe I'll do it that way. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, Slave Play happened right before the pandemic and Passover happened right after. And I don't think either of those plays are the kinds of plays that when we were writing them, we were like, oh, this is gonna go to Broadway.
Yeah.
No, nobody, you know, no.
Sure.
Off-Broadway is like, wow, okay, off-Broadway, like my play made it off-Broadway, okay, wow. You know, I thought that was, not necessarily good enough, because like, I know that my play deserves Broadway, but I also, when you see what's being done, mm-hmm. a play about what my play is about is not what, you know, people go to Broadway to feel good.
You know what I mean? Like, yeah, well, you know,
listen,
it's been like that for so long now, and it's like, is that the right way to do it always, you know?
Well, you know, I think, yeah, it's interesting, trends come and go, and there was a time when Broadway was more than musicals, mm-hmm. when, you know, the new American play was something that people thought about in the culture.
Yeah.
So, you know, for as long as I've been in the theater, people keep saying, is the theater dead? Is the theater dead? And I'm like, well, maybe if y'all quit picking dead plays. You know what I mean? Like,
yes.
The theater doesn't have to be dead. You just keep producing dead plays.
Yeah. But not with the lack of purpose, too, you know?
Like, a lack of passion.
Yeah. Revivals without a purpose. Just the purpose is to do it again, because it's so good.
The purpose, I think, is like the glorification. A lot of times I feel like the programming is just the glorification of nostalgia. And don't get me wrong, nostalgia has a place. But what I would love to see in the Broadway of the aftertimes is, oh, that theater does revivals. That theater does musicals. That theater does new crazy plays. That theater does international work. You know what I mean? Like, I don't need 8 of the same thing.
Right.
But nobody's asking me, but you, I guess maybe you're asking
me. Yeah, I mean, I am right now, so that'll do. That'll do for now. So you've obviously written other plays before Passover. Do you think that these previous plays that you've worked on, and did they prepare you necessarily to write something like Passover?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, it's interesting. Part of what I'm doing now is sort of like looking at the experience of Passover in the context of my journey as a writer. And I'm like, okay, how has my craft changed? Like, for instance, okay, I've been working on Passover for 5 years. It's been my primary play, even though I have been working on other plays, and Passover is written in verse. And so now for my next play, I long to write in prose again. And I long to reintroduce punctuation. I'm like, oh, I wanna see what it feels like, you know, to write a play that looks on the page more like a Tennessee Williams play. Like, I'm longing for that again. So yeah, every play is a continuum, because at the end of the day, my art making practice is a practice, and it's a journey from, you know what I mean? Like, when you think of an athlete, it's like, okay, well, how is your jump shot evolved over the last 20 years, Michael Jordan? You know what I mean? It's like, okay, well, Michael Jordan's gonna be able to tell you about his jump shot, because you might be seeing one game, he's seeing his jump shot, like that's a craft that he has over his life. So it's like, for me, playwriting is a craft over my life. Like, yes, there was this one production and that's beautiful and that's a snapshot, but it's like, okay, well, I've got to go back to the page tomorrow and keep doing, you know what I mean? The part that nobody sees. So everything you write, which honestly is one of the reasons why I'm trying to step a little bit back from social media, because that's fucking with my writerly voice. I don't need what I write on the page to look like to sound like a tweet. You know what I mean? And it's just like, whoa, yeah. I got to step back from that. I got to step back because I got to hone this thing here so that I can write the next play. Like, where am I in that journey of my writerly voice? So.
Yeah, that's interesting. Half the time, you don't even think about how much social media has an influence, especially as artists, on what we do and what we put out. It's a weird thing to think about, you know?
I mean, I think, one of the things, aside from just the way it can warp your voice, for me, it's like, look, writing is rewriting. And Twitter, not just Twitter, but all of social media gets me so hungry for instant gratification, right? Whereas if I'm on the page, no, I need to go back and go back. It's like, I need depth of thought. Whereas social media is about quantity and fast. And it's just like, okay, sometimes I need to step away from one so that I can nurture the part of me that like sits and thinks, you know what I mean?
Yes.
Without the having human. To like send. It's like, no, just like, think about that for 3 days before you.
Yes. Oh yeah.
Before you tweet it, you know. So
once it's out there, it's done.
Listen. Yeah.
When did you decide to write Passover? A play about two young Black men who dream of getting off their block and getting to the promised land, riffing on the structure of Waiting for Godot, using the book of Exodus. The book of Exodus. Why this story in this way?
Well, because, you know, I grew up in the church. And so the book of Exodus, specifically the Exodus story of Moses leading the people out of the promised land, is like one of my favorite Old Testament stories. I identify with it a lot, especially as a Black person in primarily white institutions. You know, that feeling of being from that group, but you get to hang out with that group and you get to be a special person in that group. It's like, okay, yeah, the Moses story really spoke to me as a child. I got to college and I read Waiting for Godot and I fell in love with Beckett. So already in my mind, there's this conversation between these two texts. And then, you know, sometimes as a writer, it takes that catalyst, it takes that event that just gets it all swirled around in your mind. So you're like, I have to write about this. So the question for me was just like, yeah, what is the promised land? Are we waiting for it? Is it going to come or is it not going to come? Because Exodus says that, you know, for the children of Israel, the promised land did come. They did get there. Whereas in Waiting for Godot, you know, they
still waiting.
Waiting. Right? So I'm kind of, you know, like, what narrative are we in? Because if we're in Waiting for Godot, then I don't know what I'm going to, you know, why am I trying to, you know, go to these protests and stuff? If it's waiting for, you know what I mean? These have real implications for my life. It's like, do I just... fuck it. You know?
Yeah. Where did that, you know, having those two stories kind of collide, where did you find the world of the play through that?
Well, that again, that's just, I think people only see that in Passover, but that's something that I do all the time. I call it like, you know, I've always been interested in graphic design. And when I was in grad school, I used to, my work study job in grad school, part of what I did was I had to design the show posters for the shows we were doing. So I've always been interested, you know, in Photoshop, how when you're making an image, you have layers, right? The layers of the image. And I've always thought of a story itself also has layers because time is the layers. Mm-hmm. The past is always the present. We're always standing on the ground. So that's something, the layers of history is something that is always present in one way or another in the work that I'm doing. So it's like, you see it in Passover, but that's what I'm talking about, the journey of my writing, where it's like, oh, that's a tool that I've created.
Would you mind discussing like the significance of the characters' names in the play? Of course, obviously Moses, but Kitch, Ossifer, and Mister. What was behind that for you?
Well, Moses and Kitch, I found their names on a slave manifest. Those are actual names of men from a South Carolina plantation. Originally, in the original version, when I first started writing, Moses was originally named Prince, because I knew that he was a prince among men. But then, if you know that Steven Spielberg cartoon, Prince of Egypt, about Moses, right? So I see this slave manifest and I see three names. I see Prince and I'm like, okay, it's going to be Prince and he needs somebody else. And I was like, it can't be Prince and Moses because those are both the same kind of. And then I see Moses and I see Kitch and I remember Prince of Egypt. And I'm like, okay, not Prince, keep Moses and keep Kitch. And I liked Kitch because I was like, that was the only name that wasn't a Bible name. And it was just like, oh, this person has kind of like it kind of sounds like kitchen. It kind of sounds like a word, you know, it's kind of like kitsch, like, oh, that's so kitschy. It's like, but it's kind of a made up name. So that's where I got those two names. And then Ossifer, I just knew that like in my family, we always call the police Ossifers because we just like, we like to do malapropisms in my family. And it's always just like, because they're slippery, you know, the police are slippery. So you just give them a name that sounds kind of slippery. So,
yeah. So, of course, Passover gets to Steppenwolf Theater in Chicago in 2017. How does Spike Lee get involved with the play? And what was your response to that once you knew that would, you know, be a thing?
Well, yeah, it was pretty crazy because the play had closed at Steppenwolf. And then I literally got a call because Spike and I have the same representation. We're at the same agency. We have different agents, but we're at the same agency. So, you know, the agents pass stuff between them. And I guess Spike has this thing where he's like, if you see something, you know, just pass it my way. And they passed him Passover and he read it. And then he literally called me up and was like, I want to film this. And at that time, you know, there had been no Zoom theater or anything like that. So I was very hesitant because I was just like, this doesn't make sense. But then he convinced me. And then it was literally just this surreal feeling of like, what's happening? Like, you know what I mean? It's one of those, I mean, this play has been and continues to be, including going to Broadway. It's like, no, that was not my goal. Like when I started writing this play, I was in such a bad place emotionally and psychologically that literally my success was finishing the play. You know what I mean? Like the career stuff came on its own and came after. I mean, I think as I grow as a writer, because now I've done some TV writing and TV writing has really helped my process, but you definitely need a lot. Yeah, like you got to write until you get something that feels good. Yeah. And sometimes you just don't know what that is. You got to explore.
We'll be right back after this break. Welcome back to the episode.
Yeah, and so I saw the Broadway production a few weeks ago, and I knew the Amazon version was out there, but I didn't want to watch it because I felt like it was one of those plays that I had to like experience for myself live. And I hope that one day I wouldn't. It happened. Thank God. And so, of course, like the biggest change of the Amazon version versus the Broadway version is the ending. And so why was it important for you to change it for Broadway and for this time?
Yeah, it started with an act of self-care. It was important because, you know, the stories, at the end of the day, stories are for the people in the moment. I believe that. Which is why with a play like this, at a time like this, when America is changing so much, like we went from, people forget, like Obama time was great. And then we went to Trump, which now nobody even talks about the fact that we went through Trump. And now we have coronavirus. It's like, okay, we've been through Trump. Literally over 1 million people have died. And then I want to tell you the story of a lynching play again. You know what I mean? The anger and the and the sense of vengeance and the sense of justice that I had before the pandemic, I'm not saying that that was right for that moment. But in this moment, when it's like, oh, you haven't even been inside a theater in 18 months. And some of you might have had COVID, been in the hospital. Some of you might have lost people. That's just not the story for this moment. Not for me. Like, if I'm going to do press from April to September on a play, like, it can't be that. I already did press on the old version. That was hard. You know what I mean? And to do that now to myself or to the audience, it's like, that's not what the audience needs right now.
And I greatly appreciate that. I greatly appreciate that, you know, because it's, you know, I've been talking to a lot of people recently, and I think it's like, what is art now after we've been through so much trauma? Like, is it using that trauma in whatever you're creating, or is it also finding joy within that trauma and finding like the right balance? And I think Passover has like the right balance of joy and of the things that people need to see in order to be educated. And I know I also read that you said that this version of the play is more for Black audiences.
Yes, absolutely. Because it centers Black joy. I even though I would never, you know, obviously every version of a play is for anybody who wants to see it, but I had white audience members in mind when I wrote the previous versions, you know what I mean? And so when Black audience members would see the previous versions, it was a sense of vindication and a sense of like, wow, you're speaking to them for us on our behalf. But that version is not directed at Black people. Black people already know that. You know what I mean? It's like, okay, if the American theater attracts a mostly white audience, well, then I'm going to talk to the, you know what I mean? I'm going to talk to people who come in. But now it's like, oh, no. I'm going to talk to Black people and we're going to do whatever we can to get Black people in, which is why the tickets are so cheap.
Yeah. And with that, when did you realize, you know, going back to the beginning of this process to Broadway, that Passover would be the first play, first new play, the first production to open up Broadway after a year and a half?
Yeah, that was, you know, literally we sealed the deal, I want to say early April. Like, it happened so fast because I was fully vaccinated on April 1st. So I know we couldn't go forward until I was fully vaccinated. So I want to say it was the second or third week of April where it was like, okay, this is going to happen. It was crazy fast. And then we were in rehearsal. Yeah. We were in rehearsal June 6th.
Was there any pressure for you? Did you feel any pressure with that?
Oh yeah, totally. Yeah. It was a pressure. I mean, I work well under pressure. Though I will say it was a pressure filled experience. Yes, absolutely.
You know, I would be remiss to talk about the production that I saw on Broadway and just like how much it moved me as an audience member, as you know, a young Black man myself. I sat in like the sixth or seventh row in the middle, and just like before there were even words spoken, you know, by the two characters, I was just moved to see those two men on stage. And so that kind of did it for me already. And like feeling the presence of like everyone around me, I could feel there were people in the room who needed to be there, people in the room who wanted to be there because they felt like this was something for them, either if they were Black or other people of color. So in terms of like how audiences are responding to it, what did you imagine their response to be, and what did you kind of didn't expect it to be, you know, afterwards?
You know, it's interesting. I always, the way that I write, it's hard to say. Okay, I grew up in church, right? And I grew up in a very evangelistic church. And I grew up learning how to tell people the gospel, right? And one of the things that I always learned is my job is to tell. It's not my job to worry about how people receive. And that has been a really great muscle for being a playwright, because my job is to tell. And I always say the audience for my play at the end of the day is whoever has ears to hear. If you have ears to hear, and if there's something in the play that moves you, then you're the audience member that needed to hear it today.
Yeah.
And whatever people walk away with, sometimes people walk away with confusion. Sometimes they walk away with anger. Sometimes they walk away with hope, with joy, with sadness. come and get your life. Come and get what it is you need.
Yeah. Yeah. That's awesome. So I'm just talking about my experience now. Forgive me. But like when I walked into the theater, of course, I heard music that sounded a little familiar. And so that's never happened with me before. So I know you created a playlist for Passover. So was that the music that was happening for pre-show?
Yes. Yes. Some of the pre-show, all of the pre-show songs are from the Passover playlist. Yes. That I made public on Spotify. Yeah. I wanted to bring people into that process. Those were the songs that I was listening to while I was doing the rewrite. So
what is your process in terms of writing and rewriting a script, you know, when looking at what you have and determining what needs to change, what should stay and what has stayed, like what's your process and what has your process been with Passover?
I mean, at the end of the day, the writing and the rewriting process is a matter of taste. You're just, you make something and then you stand back and you look at it and you say, do I like what I just made? And if you like it, then you keep going. And if you don't like it, then you got to change it. You got to figure out what you don't like and then change it. So, you know, you just do that over and over and over again until you get to something. And again, I'm a very, very picky writer. And I have very, very refined taste, which is a double-edged sword because it means I'm really picky, even with myself. But yeah, it's just a matter of refining your taste, knowing what you like and being unapologetic about that.
Was there a moment in Passover that, not just the ending, of course, but something else, another scene or piece of dialogue that has changed drastically from like the very first few drafts that we see now?
Yeah, I would say the rock moment. Mm. In the previous version, Kitch does not strike Moses with the rock. But in this version, in order to get to that ending that's more hopeful, then Kitch needed to strike Moses. And you know, right now it's sort of left up to interpretation. Is that strike, is he killing him or is he just knocking him out? But whatever he's doing, when Moses goes down, he then begins to feel all the pain that Kitch is feeling and he's able to be resurrected.
Yeah, I would say that the image of Moses standing over the ossifer, like just seeing that image of that power being like taken away and being owned by Moses. That was very powerful for me. And like, I definitely, of course I got emotional throughout the play in other sequences, but like, this was like the moment where I was like, wow, like that's something I've never seen before, you know, and to be able to put that out there for audiences to see right now after what we've seen in the past year and a half, I think was really important.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. So where do you hope to see Broadway go from here? You know, after this year, all the plays are by Black playwrights.
Yeah. I mean, I think the key to any sort of progress after this comes with ownership. That's why I'm really happy that I was a writer and a producer, because I want to keep producing plays. I want to keep producing my plays. So it's like, the only people who are going to make the progress happen are Black people. We can't rely on the goodwill of white people with money, because it's like, when it's fashionable, they will. And when it's not fashionable, they won't. And that's not good enough anymore. When it comes to a place like Broadway, which takes a lot of money, then we have to, on a certain level, build or create the kind of wealth that helps us to own the products that we make.
And we can only hope and cross our fingers that, you know, it all comes to fruition.
Yeah.
So what's next for you in terms of like, do you have any existing works that are going to be produced soon, or is Passover going to be, you know, having another production after this? What's up next?
There's no immediate plans for new productions of Passover. I'm a little bit, I need to step away from that text for a little while. It's a very difficult text. And it has been my primary focus for the last 5 years. So I think I'm super ready to be known for something else, though I am very grateful for everything that's happened. And I have some, you know, I during the pandemic, I was in my second writer's room for TV. And so I have a TV, and I have a new TV project that hopefully is going to work out. And I also have a film project. I'm in contract for two projects. So I can't really talk about, I can't say names yet, but hopefully during the fall, there'll be some fun news items about me. So let's hope, let's hope.
Yeah.
And then for the theater, you know, I've got, yeah, I've always got stuff on the burner. I've always got stuff that I can do.
And I thought it was interesting earlier that you talked about, you know, prose versus verse and how like working on verse for so long and how that will impact you going back to verse. Can you speak more about that necessarily?
Oh, I mean, I think, again, it's just like a hunger. Like I have such a desire now to like write a really long sentence of dialogue with a semicolon. Like I just, you know what I mean? Because it was so, at the time, it was so liberating. Once I decided, oh, wow, I'm really going to free this text of punctuation. It was so liberating. And there was a freedom there that I had to give myself in order to double down on the word repetition. Because I'm like, that word repetition doesn't make sense with punctuate. Like, what are we doing?
Right.
And now I'm like, okay, I've done that. You know how like when you go so far in one extreme, then you just want to go super far in another extreme. So I'm ready to write characters who talk a lot. I'm ready to write Black characters who have different dialects than that. Like, I'm just ready to do something else.
We'll be ready to see it too.
Thank you.
Yeah. And so at the end of my interviews, I always ask my people who I talk to this question. It's a big question, I don't know, depending on how you look at it, but what is your ultimate goal as an artist?
My ultimate goal as an artist actually is to live a life that is a theophany, which means to live a life that proclaims the existence, I think, of something, an energy that is bigger and greater than anything that we can see. I don't know if that energy is called God or the universe or spirit, but I know that I'm a student of religion, I'm a student of theology, and I think that there's a real closeness between art and what we call religion. And in a time when religion itself has betrayed us, then I think that we need to gather together in these art spaces to try to create the transformation that maybe we couldn't in churches. So I want my life and I want my work to remind people that like they have a higher self and that we have a responsibility to literally save the world. You know what I mean? Honestly, it's like at this moment, like if you're just doing it for a career, like what is your career going to be in 50 years when we're all floating in debt? Like, you know what I mean? I'm like, so I really do think that my art is about waking people up to their higher selves and to the fact that your higher self is in relationship to something more than just the material world.
Yeah, that's, I feel like a lot of people try to stay away from saying like, oh, my art, or not even my art, just art in general could change the world, could save the world. But I think that is really true, especially after all that we've been through and all that we're gonna continue to go through. It's like, that's the healing, you know?
Well, I mean, I don't think art alone, like, so that's the thing. I think it is a chain effect. Like, I create art that changes people and then people go out and change the world. So that's what I'm saying. Like, if you have the ears to hear what's in my art, then you're going to hear it. But I also know that a lot of people are just coming to be entertained. And they will not go out and live changed lives or be changed people. And that's not something that I can fix. But for those who can and who want to, here we go.
Yeah. Nice. So what is your advice to young Black artists or younger Black artists who are, you know, who want to be writers, who want to be producers, directors, actors, you know, what is your go-to for them?
Find your community and make art with those people as much as possible. Make, you know, poor art, quick art, flagrant art. Just find the people that you work with and make as much art as possible so that you know yourself as an artist. Just keep making and learn how to metabolize disappointment.
Yes, that's very important as someone who's that's just graduated. Really
Metabolize it, meaning use it for fuel. You must.
Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed the episode. And thank you for another great season. You can follow me on social media at Blackdirt Podcast. I'll be dropping new bonus episodes from time to time, so be sure to subscribe to the show wherever you listen to podcasts to get updates on new episodes. Well, that's a wrap. I pray you have learned something from this season, and hope you continue to stay educated, inspired, and entertained by Black artists who deserve the utmost respect and praise. It's an honor to honor them on this platform. Until next time, I'm Gabe Moses, and Black artists matter.